from the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Okay, it's finally done. Hi, everybody. Brian Kilmeade. We're done with the conventions. We have a week left, and then it's the end of summer. Do you believe it? We have a lot to get over today, especially we have a great guest this hour, Jacob Howland, Provost Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs at a brand new school. He's also Dean of Intellectual Foundations at the University of Austin, a university like none other. And you're going to hear all about it. And you might be sending your kids there, especially if you like this show. We'll discuss that in a moment. There's also going to be an active day on the campaign trail. The conventions are done, but man, nothing's slowing down. I laugh when people say after Labor Day it starts. Are you kidding me? There's only 74 days left. We just got the other candidate 3 weeks ago. Let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
And I hope the press writes this story fairly because it's a story of disgrace. We had a border czar who was the border czar. She loved the title, but she didn't want to do the work because she's lazy and probably wants to have an open border.
Yes, that is President Trump last night. He was quite active. He was at Montezuma Pass in Arizona, and he was there with some families of those who lost loved ones to illegal immigrants and the murderers that come through our border. He talks about that. We will talk about our border, too, and how it could be the deciding issue in this election.
Number two.
We got to win. We need to send Donald Trump back to the White House. We need to retake the Senate. We need to hold the House. We need to hold our legislative majorities that we have in the great state of Georgia. And it takes hard work. That's what we've been doing.
Wow. Governor Brian Kemp speaking to Sean Hannity about his new friend, Donald Trump. 74 days ago, and Trump can finally function outside of his opponent's honeymoon with two major wins. First, Trump is expected to get RFK on his team as early as today, this afternoon in Arizona. Second, he seems to have made amends with Governor Brian Kemp, which may bring the purple state back to red. We'll discuss it.
Number one.
I promise to be a president for all Americans. Donald Trump is an unserious man. The consequences of putting Donald Trump back in the White House are extremely serious.
Really? DNC done. VP Harris spoke, and we all are left to wonder, does she realize her plans, programs, and complaints all could be addressed because she is vice president? She must be reminded that she is in the current White House. So here's a couple of things. I think she did a good job on the speech. It looked great. They had entertaining speakers. I mean, look at Oprah Winfrey. The Obamas were expected to be great. I thought Clinton was meandering, but he's a shell of himself. He's dealing with some diseases. So having said that, I don't know what he's doing up there. The whole Epstein Island thing, his dealings with other people, I'm just surprised. But having said that, the DNC is just very glad to be done with Joe Biden. That's the bottom line. It's a breath of fresh air to be done with the current president because, as we were saying from day one, he's not the same guy. I said it in 2020 without a medical degree that the pandemic actually is the only way he would have gotten elected. Because if people saw him consistently, they know that he's not the same guy. He was totally unacceptable the last two times he ran. The third time he was trailing. And then they realized Bernie Sanders is going to get the nomination if we don't do something. So they propped up Joe Biden. And James Clyburn did it. But he is not active, couldn't work more than 4 hours a day, doesn't do press conferences, doesn't do interviews. And when you bring it up, they were telling us that, well, behind the scenes, he's a dynamo. We didn't believe it then. Jon Stewart laughed about it. And then, after a terrible debate in June, they all really said the same thing. He's out. Why? He's trailing by 3 points. Why'd you kick him out? Because everything that we were saying, that you were seeing, was true. And they knew it. So Speaker Pelosi teams up with the Obamas and George Clooney, and they kick him to the curb. One by one, lawmakers jumped the fence and said, he's out. We will lose an election with him. So with him gone, and them finally willing to admit that he was one of the problems, his policies were terrible. His unpopularity was real at 38% approval. They were going to lose the House, lose the Senate, and the White House. Donald Trump had basically won this thing. They kicked him to the curb. And when it was all said and done, Kamala Harris did a good job behind the scenes. Even Nancy Pelosi says she thought it would be an open process, that she didn't anticipate her rounding up all the delegates. So she rounded up all the delegates. She became the nominee. They rallied around her, and they expect us to not remember that Jamie Raskin, Nancy Pelosi, Elizabeth Warren, Andrea Mitchell, who might as well be part of the administration, have all basically said that she's an albatross, done nothing, and she's not effective on the ticket. She should be replaced. She had 32% approval rating. But they expect us to ignore that, too. And then yesterday, after talking to her in glowing terms for 4 days, she went and gave a speech for 40 minutes, 37 minutes. And just like I thought, she's a bright woman, experienced, 60 years old, been in the public eye since she was 26, 27, but delivered a good speech. Okay. Let's listen to a little of it. Here's Kamala Harris. Cut three.
I know there are people of various political views watching tonight, and I want you to know I promise to be a president for all Americans. In many ways, Donald Trump is an unserious man. The consequences of putting Donald Trump back in the White House are extremely serious. He would use the immense powers of the presidency of the United States, not to improve your life, not to strengthen our national security, but to serve the only client he has ever had, himself.
Okay, a couple of things. If you look at Donald Trump's life before or after, the theme, one of the themes, one of the three themes, was that Donald Trump is in this, he's selfish. It's all about him. So let's just think about this. He was worth $3.3 billion when he got into the race. He's now worth $2.3 billion. Seems like he lost. George Bush got in, was worth $20 million. He's now worth $40 million. I'm the biggest George Bush fan in the world. I have no problem with that. You know what? Bill Clinton came in. He was worth like $100,000. He's worth $240 million. Please tell me where Donald Trump was there in the White House to enrich himself. As he gets impeached twice, four indictments, two of these civil trials have cost him hundreds of millions of dollars. Think about his family's reputation. Eric and Don, people love him. Now they hate him. Some people love his hotels. Now they hate him. Everyone loved Donald Trump. Think about Barron. He asked his teenage son to sacrifice and go to three high schools in 4 years. Melania and Donald Trump, does anybody think that their relationship got better after he became president and then after he lost? Does anybody think that their relationship could hold up to this type of scrutiny? But this guy's also got shot at, almost killed. You think that intrigues him? The guy is wearing a suit at the border yesterday. Does he do that because he wants personal fame? So that I don't get. And if you don't want to vote for Trump, just don't do it because you think he's in it for himself. She said a bunch of things that just weren't right. And it might not bother you. It bothers me. Cut one.
We know what a second Trump term would look like. It's all laid out in Project 2025, written by his closest advisors. And its sum total is to pull our country back to the past. We are not going back to when Donald Trump tried to cut Social Security and Medicare. As a part of his agenda, he and his allies would limit access to birth control, ban medication abortion, and enact a nationwide abortion ban with or without Congress.
Yeah, you might say, wow, what great delivery. She looked fantastic in that business suit. Look at the lighting. But let's look at the substance for a second. I don't want to slow you down, but I think it's important. Project 2025 was by the Heritage Foundation, a bunch of great people. I've spoken in front of the organization. I think they're the largest think tank in Washington. They're conservatives. Kevin Roberts runs the place. Extremely buttoned up guy. Great organization. And when conservatives are done, like Senator Jim DeMint quit, and then Tim Scott, you may remember, was appointed by Governor Nikki Haley to take over. When he quit, he ran the Heritage Foundation. A lot of conservatives in and out of White Houses, Congress, they will go there if they're conservatives. You know, you walk around, oh, I remember you used to be in Tennessee. Okay. So former Trump employees go there. Staffers go there. Absolutely. Because they go there, that means Donald Trump wrote it. Donald Trump subscribing to it. 900 pages. You can't tell me that he doesn't read anything at the same time say he basically authored a 900-page doctrine to how to run his administration. Really? I thought you told us he made it up on the fly, that he didn't prepare, didn't read anything. But he's going to go ahead and put together a 900-page doctrine or, I don't know, curate it. Stop with the 2025. It doesn't make any sense. I think the Brookings Institute is an example of a left-wing organization, think tank. Now, if they came out with a detailed study and some former Biden, Obama, and Harris staffers were there, does that mean that Kamala Harris is part of that? No, it does not mean that. So why would we believe that 2025 is something? Donald Trump was asked that specifically about 2025 by, I think, me. And he answered flat out, I have nothing to do with 2025. So I'm not even going to play the clip. But the second thing was cutting Medicare and cutting Social Security. He's not doing either one of those things. Now, Social Security needs to be addressed. The criticism on Donald Trump would be, what do you mean? It's got to be fixed. But nobody's looking at that entitlement. You know, there should be things like you should have an option to go into the market with your money. It's your money. But when George W. Bush brought that up, they said he was trying to play Russian roulette with people's futures and retirements, even though it would have been their decision. So he couldn't get that done. But having said that, never thought about cutting Medicare. What he says is don't give Medicare to illegal immigrants. Are you against that? So he's not looking to ban abortion. He's never said he's looking to ban abortion. He's turning it over to the states, much to the chagrin of the pro-life movement. Do you think that he would have made the decision Ohio made? I don't think so. Very stark decision, very tough on abortion in Texas. He didn't make that decision either. 6 weeks in Florida. But in other red states like Kansas, there's pretty liberal policy when it comes to abortion. He turns it over to the states, so stop missaying it. And he never came out against the abortion drug, even though the pro-life people are mad at him for not doing that. And he didn't pick a week, even though some people say just do what Europe does and say 15 weeks. He didn't do it. So if you want to say he should have picked 15 or 16 weeks, sure. But just understand, too, you can go right to the point of birth in Minnesota and in California. And there were five separate incidents where babies were actually born. Only two were given life-ending comfort drugs. The rest just died in Minnesota. So if you want to start talking about this ugly part and this hardest decision ever, but if you're Kamala Harris, you're actually glorifying it. They say this is a definitive moment for her. No one ever talks about, we weren't talking about abortion since I got to Fox until the last year. 74 days to Election Day. Trump's got to push back on all those things. He's got $400 million to get out ads. She might have more money. That's fine, but you got enough. Internet, TV, billboards, spread them out. And for Donald Trump to get the message out, she'll be very smooth on the stump. She's going to take very few questions. What you got to do is keep pushing her to take questions. Have situations where you have a reporter at every stop throwing out some questions where she can't get away. And we saw with Biden, he wants to go out, but the question is so loud and clear. It looks like he can't answer unless he stops. So I'm not really sure how she got the job. I know she seemed to be quite ready for it, but no one's accusing her of maybe pushing him over the ledge, meaning Joe Biden. She did have nice things to say. Cut 11.
To our President Joe Biden, when I think about the path that we have traveled together, Joe, I am filled with gratitude. Your record is extraordinary, as history will show, and your character is inspiring.
Good, because that's your record, too. So your record when Afghanistan, our pull out of Afghanistan, where you live hundreds of millions of dollars worth of equipment there, they're still using and selling. You went to California while also telling Dana Bash you were the last one in the room. It was your plans that you were proud of, wrote the tide-breaking vote on the Inflation Reduction Act, on the rescue package, on the infrastructure deal. Nothing's been done on infrastructure. The Inflation Reduction Act has not been implemented. Most of the money's not been spent. And infrastructure has gotten us 8 terminals and no internet for rural areas. So that's what you got to run on and defend. And that's what the president's got to bring out September 10th. I just spoke to Kelsey Gabbard, who's working with him on the debates. He says he knows his stuff inside and out. Now, I asked her that before I got on camera and after. So if she easily say, well, you know, we just had a brief conversation. She says, no, he was ready to go on almost all these issues. And I said, did you look at the way she prosecuted and cross-examined some of these nominees like General Kelly when he was Homeland Security Secretary, like William Barr when he went for a nomination, Justice Kavanaugh was looking for confirmation. Did you see the way she questioned? She could do the same to you. You got to be ready. President, unfortunately, as of for him, has a lot of experience with lawyers and attorneys. They brought up January 6th last night. They also brought out foreign policy. They brought out foreign policy, and this is where I think she's extremely vulnerable. Listen to what she's calling for in Gaza. Cut eight.
At the same time, what has happened in Gaza over the past 10 months is devastating. So many innocent lives lost. Desperate, hungry people fleeing for safety over and over again. The scale of suffering is heartbreaking.
Couple of things. When you had a chance, she does back Israel, and I'll play that clip next half hour. But when she does back Israel, she gets a lot of applause. She gets more applause when she talked about Gaza. Shows you where the Democratic constituency is. Number two is when you had a chance to show you how tight you were with Israel, you didn't show up when Netanyahu addressed Congress. You chose to do something else. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. When we come back, your calls, 1-866-408-7669. What'd you think? 4 days in, begin and done. What did you think was accomplished? Don't move.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network, subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
You guys can see the flags in New York, but the amount... We've talked a lot over the course of the last couple days about how Democrats are trying to reclaim patriotism, and I really feel like it culminated in this night. I mean, there are these gigantic flags. There's the chicks singing the Star Spangled Banner. There's this thesis that I think came into sort of full flower tonight with Kamala Harris making the argument that the true strength, the true integrity, the true patriotism lies in the Democratic Party. And they have opened the flaps of the tent to encompass Republicans, to encompass doubters, to encompass people that felt culturally divorced from the party for decades. And here we have, I think, one of the broadest, deepest, most diverse coalitions I've ever seen.
Yeah.
All of them marching under the stars and stripes. It's really something else. This is a Democratic convention.
If you are talking patriotism and it's sincere, it's great. I love it. Whatever it is, I love the fact that they actually had flags up, not nearly as much as the Republicans, but why they're doing it, as experts will tell you, is to try to claim the Midwest and the South or anybody. Because if you want North Carolina and you're going to walk around saying anti-American phrases, you're not going to get the bulk of that state, believe me, extremely patriotic. It should not be. Patriotism should not belong to one party. But unfortunately, if you had an American flag on your car, you were basically saying that you weren't a Democrat. Now they're trying to reclaim it. They got to earn it. But I like the fact that both parties can get on the same page for our 250th birthday in 2026, which is coming pretty quick. Jacob Hawan next.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome back, everyone. Jacob Hawan joins us now, Provost, Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs, and Dean of Intellectual Foundations at the University of Austin. So, of course, it's an important time to have a university provost on, but what makes it really special is this college university is like no other, and they're starting their first on-campus semester right now, and it's a lot different than you would think or most colleges typically are. Jacob, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's great to be here, Brian. Thank you.
So, Jacob, tell me what makes the University of Austin different and how special this month will be.
Okay, well, we are unlike other universities because other universities have really lost the thread. The purpose of a university is to pursue truth and to preserve, transmit, and extend knowledge. Now, I think most universities, or at least many, have turned into sort of joyless centers of indoctrination. And there are, you know, statistics that support that in terms of, let's say, the ratio of conservatives to liberals on campus, which is a kind of index of intellectual pluralism. But the main point I would make is that in the contemporary universities, students are afraid to make mistakes, and you can't learn if you make mistakes. They're afraid to make mistakes because they don't want to be censored. They don't want to be canceled. If I told you you had to learn how to ride a bike, but you couldn't fall off, you wouldn't be able to do it. Mm-hmm. So what we're doing is founding a university on the principles of open discourse, civil discourse, you know, the pursuit of truth. We are not going to have ideology in the classroom, and students will not be biting their tongues, nor will professors.
So some of the bigger names that had decided this was necessary and they combined to come out. Neil Ferguson, one of the smartest guys you'll talk to. We have Joe Lonsdale, too. He's also made a huge impact. Yeah, Barry Weiss, too, of the Free Press, formerly the New York Times. This is a group of people that came together that saw a huge problem. Doesn't mean it necessarily you agree and vote for the same people, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think there is intellectual pluralism and diversity of viewpoints on the board. But we are not interested in being, let's say, a university of the right. We're interested in transcending politics. So we're not going to be another Hillsdale. That already exists. It does really well. God bless them. We want to be a place where all views are representative and we can have open discourse and collective inquiry into the fundamental problems of human existence.
How hard was it to get this off the ground? What was the greatest hurdle?
Well, I'll tell you, I would say the greatest hurdle has been regulatory capture. There's been no new secular or non-sectarian university in Texas in over 50 years, and there are good reasons for that. It's very hard to start a new university. So, for example, before you are nationally accredited, which cannot occur until you graduate the first class of undergraduates, you cannot advertise your university at college fairs at high schools. You cannot accept federal money in terms of financial aid, no Pell Grants. Parents can't use their 529 savings plans. So it's a big risk to, you know, say that your son or daughter is going to start at this university. And it's a big risk for faculty and frankly for the administrators and staff. You know, we've all joined this project because we're all on board in the belief that universities need to be rebuilt. They've been central to the lifeblood of the American economy, to developing leadership, to developing American citizens. They're not doing that anymore.
Give me an idea of some of your staff and some of the courses that you guys offer.
Sure. So we have a very interesting curriculum. The way we look at education is, like rowers, you got to look backward in order to look forward. And we are very forward looking. That's, by the way, why we're building our university in Austin. You know, Tocqueville in the 1830s came to the United States and was amazed at the civic entrepreneurship. Americans would look at a problem, they'd form a committee, and they'd tackle it. That's what Austin is like. It's a big startup city. So our university has three real dimensions in the curriculum. One is intellectual foundations, which I designed, which is studying the best that has been thought and said, focusing on fundamental human questions like what is civilization, what is politics, why do we need law? So there's that part. And then students have the opportunity after their freshman and sophomore years to develop 21st century techniques, tools, intellectual tools to focus on contemporary problems, you know, that are related to computing and AI and so forth. But the sort of through line that connects this backward-looking and forward-looking curriculum is our Polaris project, named after the North Star. And the idea is that once you do intellectual foundations and you come to understand the conditions of human flourishing, what is a human being? What do human beings need? You then develop a project to attend to the needs of human beings today in 2024. And so you're actually applying your liberal education. So that's, I think, a very distinctive feature of our curriculum. And it's an interesting and creative tension between this preservation, the grateful reception of the knowledge and wisdom of our ancestors, and applying it looking forward to make the world better.
Jacob Hallin, our guest provost, senior VP for academic affairs, dean of intellectual foundation at the University of Austin, about to launch. How much does it cost? What kind of students are you looking for?
Well, we're actually scholarshiping our students this year and next year. So we're giving them full tuition because, frankly, Brian, you know, there are tens of thousands of students who want to attend the University of Austin. They just don't know that we exist. And they're taking a big risk coming here. So, but we've pegged our tuition at $32,500, which is less than half of what a major elite institution charges. And the students not only that we're looking for, that, but that we have attracted are outstanding. We have students who have started multiple businesses, students who have produced films dealing with cancer, students, and incidentally, these students, before we've even started, the first class is on September 9th, they've gotten together to write, direct, and produce a film, to start a Substack, to form reading groups. So they're very bold and ambitious in terms of their education. And we are going to continue attracting those students. And also, we've attracted faculty who really match those students in terms of their capabilities and interests.
I imagine some of them have to be frustrated with the current system right now. You know, just talking to Jordan Peterson, who used to teach at, I think, Harvard. He just said they don't even recognize the place. They used to have a great faculty in the 90s and be able to talk and banter about issues. Now, if you have a conservative point of view, you're ostracized. They really just want you out. In Austin is an enclave of Texas. It's known to be very liberal. Homeless problem, things that just don't exist in other areas of Texas. Is Austin welcoming to you?
Austin has been pretty welcoming. You know, we have a lot of supporters from Austin. You're right that it is sort of a, let's say, blue or purple enclave within Texas. But Texas as a whole has really welcomed us. There's a lot of wealth here. We've gotten a lot of donors. We've raised, you know, almost $200 million. And we're also getting national support as well, especially a lot of interest from some of the folks who are alumni of Harvard and Columbia and places and are not interested anymore in donating to those schools. I do think that Austin is an excellent place for us to start. There's just so much vibrant energy here.
So Jacob, what type of professors want to teach there? And are you competitive salary-wise where you could get quality?
We certainly are competitive salary-wise. Now, Austin is an expensive town, but you know, we are paying, for example, at the entry level of assistant professor, $90,000 a year. And listeners who happen to be in academia will know that that is a very good salary. And the faculty that we've been attracting, you know, some have left institutions where they've been canceled or they're just upset about the ideological invasion of the classroom. But others are coming to Austin, for example, because they're interested in opportunities to extend their research in ways that aren't available elsewhere. So we have a professor, her name is Elia Overby, who's coming from Cornell. And she is, her field is bioastronautics. She studies the effects on the human body of being in space for a long time. She's in Austin because this is where SpaceX is. This is where Elon Musk is. This is where the future of technology in terms of space exploration is situated. And so she has opportunities that she doesn't have at Cornell. And that's the kind of professor we're getting, folks who are not interested in being able to say, I'm at a top university. Yeah. Look at how much honor and prestige I have. They're interested in what they're studying and what they're teaching.
But that could be the case in a few years where people thought are going to look at your place and it will have that reputation. And it's important for, I guess, you get off on the right foot. So when you look at the students, what student body do you have now to start? What did you discover in the summer in your trial run? Are there dorms on campus for them to live in?
Lots of good questions. So we're starting with 90, maybe 92, 93 students where students are still interested in applying. We decided to set a target of 100 or thereabouts because if you launch a university and you say, oh, we're going to have 1,000 students to begin with, well, you got to hire hundreds of faculty and you're actually going to have lost the game right there because we're very selective. We want to make sure that the faculty we are bringing in are mission aligned, that they buy our notion of restoring intellectual pluralism, civil discourse, asking questions and making mistakes in the classroom so students can learn. Students do have dorms. They're actually they're going to be living about a mile and a half from campus in the region of the University of Texas, which, as you know, is also in Austin. But we're going to have shuttle buses to bring them down. They're in a lovely building. Actually, some of our faculty are envious of their accommodations. So, you know, what's important to remember is that we've got great students. We've got outstanding faculty whom I've chosen because they're outstanding teachers. We have a campus. We have accommodations, you know. But the procedure is kind of chunky because we ourselves are a startup. And if you talk to anybody who's in startup, You know, you make mistakes, but we've got students and faculty who are on board with us. They're going to help us build this institution, and we're going to constantly course correct. We're very lucky to have these excellent people joining us.
All right. So do you know, we have this whole protest movement going on. The anti-Israel, pro-Palestinian movement. Do you expect that on your campus?
I don't actually expect it on our campus, but if it were to occur, we would shut it down immediately because, you know, the condition for pursuing truth and for teaching and learning is having no interruptions of those intellectual activities. And we're simply not going to tolerate it. My bigger concern, Brian, is there might be some folks in Austin at the University of Texas, for example, who were protesting Palestinian protesters. And some of that might spill over sort of into our vicinity, which is downtown.
Mm-hmm.
But frankly, I'm not very concerned about that at this point.
All right, Jacob, exciting time. Good, your first, everyone will always remember the first class of professors, first class of students. And I look forward to checking in with you again and seeing how everything progresses.
Thanks so much, Brian. I really appreciate being on your show.
Yeah, best of luck. There's the provost for one of a few moments of downtime. We'll talk about this exciting time, the launch of University of Austin. All right, when we come back, I'll take some of your calls. We'll talk about what happened in the final day of the DNC, why I believe there are two things happening for the Trump team that's going to give them their first momentum they had in 3 weeks. I'll discuss when we return.
Educating, entertaining, enlightening. You're with Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
What people miss is the difference between 2016 and 2020. In 2016, you had two third-party candidates who ran very aggressive campaigns, picked up 4-5% of the vote. You also had depressed African-American turnout in Philadelphia, Detroit, and Milwaukee. In 2020, you did not have a third-party candidate, and turnout was elevated. And I think sometimes people miss where the swing vote in these swing states is not only these independent voters, it's also voters who don't consistently turn out. And so I think that the factor of the third-party candidate is very interesting. Robert Kennedy seems to be on his way out of the race.
Yeah.
If he exits the race, then you really have a binary choice that's much clearer, more like 2020 than 2016.
No doubt about it. And I think it's going to be real. It's going to be a binary choice unless you think that RFK has followers more than Jill Stein has followers, you know, more than, Ralph Nader has followers. I believe he's got followers. And that's why I believe it's significant. If he comes out and then campaigns for Trump and says, look, you know me, I'm an environmentalist. You know, I've been a Democrat. You know, I'm where I stand on all these liberal issues. And I still think that Trump is better for America. And what's happening with this party right now is going to be terrible for the country. If he delivers, let's say 2%, you take 2% in these battleground states, they flip. The other big story is Brian Kemp. So Brian Kemp went on with Sean Hannity last night and made it clear to one person in particular, Donald Trump, who was watching, that I'm all in for you. I've got my team out for you. I have had a substantial win on a disappointing year for Republicans against their number one star, Stacey Abrams, on pure performance. I have a machine inside Georgia. I also did voting reform to tighten up everything, put up with a lot of headwinds because of it. It turns out turnout was not hindered at all. So Governor Brian Kemp said this, cut 26.
We got to win. You know, we got to win from the top of the ticket on down. I've been saying consistently for a long time, we cannot afford another 4 years of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And I think, you know, Kamala Harris and Tim Walz would be even worse. So we need to send Donald Trump back to the White House. We need to retake the Senate. We need to hold the House. We need to hold our legislative majorities that we have in the great state of Georgia. And it takes hard work. That's what we've been doing.
For him to say that at a time in which they were going at each other personally, and now they put it really more Trump on Kemp, they put it behind him. Trump heard that, hopped on last night after Kamala Harris spoke. Cut 27.
Well, I just saw Brian on a very good man. Did you ever hear of a man named Sean Hannity? And he was interviewed by Sean Hannity. And he was very nice, and he said he wants Trump to win, and he's going to work with me 100%, and I think we're going to have a very good relationship with Brian Kemp.
You understand that without Brian Kemp, knowing this is going to be a two-point race in Georgia, you probably lose the state. And knowing that 3 weeks ago, Trump called him out because Mrs. Kemp came out and said, I don't think I could support Donald Trump. And Trump was really angry. So you got to be kidding me. You unleashed this. You haven't stopped this case, Fannie Willis, from coming at me. And now this. Now, he has nothing to do with that case. Can't really stop it that I can tell. And Brian Kemp never really went at Trump. They just had a disagreement on the election and what happened and what could be done in 2020. I don't want to go over that. You don't want to go over that. But do you realize that Brian Kemp on board and Governor Nikki Haley said, if they ask me, I will come. These are the 1 or 2 point things that happen in North Carolina, in Georgia, throughout the South. They will get people to say, look, they disagreed. They had their problems, but they offer a solution. And the friction and the fighting is coming to an end. Now, you might not think it's a big deal, but when these elections are so close, I think it's a huge deal. So next thing you know, if you see Kemp and Trump on maybe, I don't know, going through the state of Georgia, big and small towns, starting in Atlanta, trying to take something out there. Nobody knows it better than Kemp. And Kemp is smart, too, because whether Trump wins or loses, he's done. And in, after 2 years, he's done as governor, term limited out. So then he's going to decide he's got a legitimate shot at being president, or at least running for president, getting a lot of money behind him. He's got some backers. He'd be different. You don't want to have the Trump crowd fighting you. For you to win, you don't want to be an enemy of Trump. You don't necessarily need the whole Trump fanfare, but you don't want to be an enemy of the movement, and neither does Nikki Haley. So you help them out, get the same objective, and then you have your own future.
Top Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I want Brian Kilmeade here coming to you from Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. This hour going to be joined by President Trump's newest senior advisor, and that is Tim Murtaugh. He's the author of Swing Hard, In Case You Hit It, My Escape from Addiction and Shot of Redemption. Great guy, great story, very loyal to Trump, very smart, and he is now in. Lewandowski is now all in, and he's helping out, and I think it's time this game to really start. Dennis Ross is standing by, too. Dennis, if you want to unwind what's happening in the Middle East and get a clue on what might be happening next, he does it all. He's William Davidson's Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, wrote many books about this area, this region, knows all the players. So before we get to Dennis, let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
And I hope the press writes this story fairly because it's a story of disgrace. We had a border czar who was the border czar. She loved the title, but she didn't want to do the work because she's lazy and probably wants to have an open border.
Trump back at the border and back with an aggressive assassin on his tail. No joke. The guy's already wanted for a DUI, already wanted for child porn, and he wants to also kill President Trump. They got to him in time. We'll discuss that, his message at the border, and what is it like being him.
Number two.
We got to win. We need to send Donald Trump back to the White House. We need to retake the Senate. We need to hold the House. We need to hold our legislative majorities that we have in the great state of Georgia. And it takes hard work. That's what we've been doing.
Yeah, there he is. Brian Kemp now on board the Trump train again. That is huge news. 74 days to go, and Trump can finally function outside of his opponent's honeymoon with two major wins. First, Trump's expected to get RFK on his team. Second, he seems to have made amends with Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, and he might be one of the most successful governors in the country, certainly one of the most popular, and that is a purple state that he needs to win.
Number one.
I promise to be a president for all Americans. Donald Trump is an unserious man. The consequences of putting Donald Trump back in the White House are extremely serious.
Kamala Harris weighing in. The DNC is done. VP Harris spoke, and we all are left to wonder what she realized, whether she realizes or not, her plans, programs, and complaints could all be addressed because she is the vice president of the United States. She also brought up her policy on Israel. She said she's formally going to back Israel, no doubt about it. But she also came back and said this. Cut 8.
At the same time, what has happened in Gaza over the past 10 months is devastating. So many innocent lives lost. Desperate, hungry people fleeing for safety over and over again. The scale of suffering is heartbreaking.
So, the suffering's heartbreaking, but does she realize all of this is because of Hamas? Dennis Ross is with us right now. Ambassador, welcome back.
Always good to be with you, Brian.
Ambassador, what were you listening to hear from Kamala Harris, and what did you take from it?
Well, I heard two things, much like you. Look, I think what I heard on Israel was we will always support Israel, and that Israel had a right to defend itself, and we would do everything we could to ensure it had the means. And she also called out Hamas the way she should have for what they did on October 7th. And I think it was important that John Paul and Rachel Goldberg, the parents of Hirsch Goldberg, who was one of the people seized from the Nova Music Festival, had part of his arm blown off, is still being held. It was important that they addressed the Democratic National Convention, because they also highlighted, again, where all this started with Hamas. Now, they also called out, look, you wouldn't be human if you weren't concerned about the suffering within Gaza, because the suffering in Gaza is real. I also would say, and this is what you were getting at, isn't it interesting that Hamas built 300 miles of tunnels, mm-hmm. and those tunnels were never made available to the Gazans? If the Israelis are going to be bombing, which they're going to be bombing, because they're going after Hamas, which embeds itself in populated areas, if Hamas cared one whit about its public, it would have allowed them to come into the tunnels. But, of course, they didn't, because they don't care about their public. They treat their public not simply as human shields. They treat their public as if they're all prepared to be martyrs, only they never ask their public if they're prepared to be martyrs. So, look, I heard two things, and the observation about suffering is real. Hamas bears most of the responsibility for that. And could the Israelis have done things differently, at least in terms of humanitarian assistance? Yes, for sure. From the very beginning, I called attention to the fact that it was in Israel's interest to make it clear they were fighting Hamas and trying to minimize the casualties and the suffering of the Palestinians who live there. That they could have done much more. It wasn't a popular thing to do in Israel because hostages were being held. Many people in Israel, and this was left to right in Israel, by the way, felt, why should we do anything for people in Gaza so long as our hostages are being held and there's no access for them and the Red Cross can't see them? I understood the sentiment, but leadership required that Israel needed the time and space to do what was necessary militarily, and for that, you can't look like you're creating a humanitarian disaster in Gaza, and they waited far too long to do much when it came to that.
Dennis, you've been to Gaza, right?
I have. I spent a lot of time in Gaza.
Very few people can say that. So I can only judge from afar. I know one thing. I am not looking for facts from the Hamas information services, and I also just know how the ethics in which the IDF is trained. I don't think anybody in that army, maybe a handful of lunatics are in every army, want one innocent person killed. But when you put your Hamas higher-ups in tunnels, in hospitals, in schools, and mosques, and that's where 28,000 are hanging out, after a while you say to yourself, it's incumbent on my people, I have to protect my to get these guys in a finite amount of time. And you go in, but you ultimately, in war that they started, you got to say to yourself, what is my objective? So knowing that they want to minimize of casualties, but also knowing that they hide amongst civilians, what do you do? Do you put your own people in jeopardy and go through one by one and try to do some type of biometric test?
Now, look, you put your finger on something, and it's something I've been trying to call attention to. Israel was faced with a very cruel dilemma. The cruel dilemma was, we can't put ourselves in a position again where Hamas can ever do what they did on October 7th. That's unthinkable. So we have to be able to prevent that. We have to be able to prevent them reconstituting themselves. At the same time, the more we go after them, given how they embed themselves, there's going to be civilian casualties. So trying to resolve that cruel dilemma is actually almost impossible. One of the things that's required, by the way, this needs to be something that we put before the international agenda. There is international humanitarian law needs to be revisited because it was shaped when we were talking about interstate conflicts, not conflicts between states and non-state actors, not conflicts between those who embed themselves in populated areas with the express purpose of putting those who are going after them in a position where either they can't go after them, which they validate their ability to continue to threaten others, or if they do go after them, they pay the price with being tarnished and stigmatized internationally. And so you end up with the ICC and the ICJ making these decisions without reference to the fact that this is a dilemma that any state is going to face when you're dealing with groups like Hamas or Hezbollah or Al-Qaeda. This is something that we have to confront, and we have not done it yet. No administration, by the way, has. It's time that whoever emerges next year in 2025 needs to take this issue on in a very frontal way.
I mean, basically, you have Israel who says it might be in their best interest to get this fight done now, because the opponents are only going to get more fortified, because you have 150,000 rockets from Hezbollah devastate Israel, no question. And then you have Iran clearly in a transit, in an uneasy situation with a new president, and not much in terms of a fighting force, and not much in terms of a missile defense. That could all change with this new alliance with North Korea, Russia, and China. So this might be the moment with the whole country on a war footing where you do it. When Netanyahu says, listen, I don't know what my future is anyway, but it's in the best interest to go forward, does it? So your thoughts about this moment for Israel?
Look, you again sort of identify what I consider to be the crux of the matter. My own view, however, is the following. Israel's never fought a war like the one it's been in. Its own military needs time to recoup. I've been in Israel twice for extended periods since October 7th, including this summer. And I've spoken to some of the people who have been called up 3 and 4 times already. It reminds me very much of what happened with our own forces in Iraq, where you had people constantly having to go back. The impact on the families is terrible, as you might imagine. And the need for, and especially at a time when, the Haredi, the ultra-Orthodox, continue to reject being drafted. You know, the 3,000 draft notices were sent out, 48 showed up, and there were demonstrations against it. Israel will have to sort this issue out. The Supreme Court made the decision.
For everyone at home, if you're ultra-Orthodox, you do not have to go serve in the military, and a law was just passed that they do now, and they're not, they don't want to go.
That's right. They study Torah instead, although part of the problem is some of those who are in that community who don't go to yeshivas, they're still also not serving, and it's not fair. I mean, you can't have a small part of the country responsible for fighting the wars, paying the taxes, and working. And this will have to be sorted out because there's a shortage of personnel. Anyway, I answer your question by saying I think the IDF needs a respite, number one. Number two, there isn't the kind of consensus in the country over this right now that there would need to be. And number three, a war with Hezbollah, it's not just 150,000 rockets. It's not a war that you can easily define how it ends. So to be in a war in Lebanon that you don't know how it ends, and you're still in a war in Gaza that you haven't been able to end yet, you would be playing into Iran's hands. What is Iran's strategy towards Israel? It's not to drop a nuclear bomb on Israel, even though they want to have that capability, because they know if they do it, they know what the consequence is. No, their strategy is to make Israel unlivable. And if you consume Israel in two wars of attrition, you're doing a lot to begin to make it unlivable. So Israel needs to be smart about this. And I'll tell you, Brian, again, whomever is the next administration, here again, I would say, no administration has been particularly successful in terms of dealing with Iran. We're going to need a different kind of strategy towards Iran, not only in terms of the dealing with the proxies, but also in terms of the nuclear program. One of the things I would want, I have a book that comes out early next year, and I'll come on your show to talk about it. I have one long chapter on Iran. I went through every administration from Jimmy Carter's to today in terms of how to deal with Iran, who was more successful, who was less successful, what can be done. What it comes down to is the following. It's fine to squeeze Iran economically, although it's quite clear they seem to be willing to absorb that. What they fear is direct conflict with us. There's a lot of bluster, but they fear direct conflict with us. And one of the things that's important to do is for them to understand which behaviors, and especially in the nuclear area, that they're going to continue with their nuclear program. They need to know the next administration, whomever it is, sends a message to them that's unmistakable, and then you do rehearsals with your forces to show you mean what you say, that we will take out their entire nuclear infrastructure, which they've spent hundreds of billions of dollars on over the last 40 years. Let them know if we identify them moving towards a weapon, that that's going to be the consequence. And we should condition the international community that this is coming, because that the more they see us preparing the ground for that, the more they'll understand we're quite serious about it. They have consistently backed off when they fear there is a direct threat with us. It doesn't mean at the same time you put them only in the corner so they feel they have nothing to lose, but you also basically make it clear here's what they do have to lose, and if they change their behavior, here's what they could gain.
That'd be great. These people should keep in mind, too, Israel has a bunch of people that are looking to no longer be at war with them, to trade with them. Iran is stopping it, and fear of Iran is the other thing. If you could put them in check, just let the Saudis emerge. They're more transactional, and then there will not be an Israeli problem if you could solve the Iranian problem, which is going to be tough because they supply all the enemies. And nobody knows more about the history of the region than Dennis Ross. That's why it was so valuable talking to you. And then understand the next president that comes in there clearly has to have Israel's back. Dennis, thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Brian. Always good to be with you.
All right, 1-866-408-7669. Tim Murtaugh will go inside the Trump camp and his strategy now with 74 days out. But next is your calls, 1-866-408-7669. I do have to tell you that in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, basically they had the Fed chairman just say it is time for a rate cut. The market has just spiked up 322 points. Don't move.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Kamala Harris. I call her comrade because she is a radical left Marxist. She wants open borders. She wants our country. I don't understand why anybody would want it, but she wants our country to be open to the world's criminals so they can come in and rape and pillage and do whatever they have to do. But she's the most radical left person who has ever run for high political office in our country's history.
And that is President Trump yesterday at the border. He met with the angel families, those who lost their lives due to illegal immigrants. These are criminals that come across. Most of them have huge track records. They don't just come here and just commit crimes. They've already proven to be criminals. They get through somehow. 8 million plus, countless gotaways. So he was there yesterday, and now Kamala Harris is trying to paint herself tough on the border. Instead of trying to excuse the border and trying to say Trump was too tough on the border, their new strategy is, I'm tough on the border. I've always been tough on the border. They think that you do not remember who has been the worst on the border in your lifetime. The numbers do not lie. There's a reason why the Border Patrol is all voting for Trump. There's a reason why the Border Patrol all hates her. There's a few sheriffs here and there that know she's a total phony. When she was attorney general, she went down to the photo op, didn't say hello to one sheriff, one Border Patrol person, got in, got out. Never went there as a vice president. She might have went there as a California attorney general. But for the most part, unbelievably weak, trying to paint herself strong, and keeps talking to pathway to citizenship. Again, that's even a little thick-headed, because there is nobody here that looks at that looks at this situation and says, let's get that pathway to citizenship going. They are so upset, They're not even talking about the Dreamers, something we almost agreed on as a country, both parties, a short time ago. So Trump's got to go and make sure that means a double-figure advantage for him. He needs that. He needs inflation. He needs the economy. And he needs it constant. He needs good ads, good people around him. They'll have more money. They will not. They'll have a compliant press. But you'll be surprised. There are people that are going to ask her real questions. And some people in the media. And she's got to have answers. Her track record is she doesn't. Ever.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
The power of patriotism is real. When I saw these American flags in here, I was thinking, what have we identified with the left for the last few months in this country? Waving around the Palestinian flags, the Hezbollah flags, everything we've seen on campuses and out in the streets. They did not permit any of that to permeate the hall. That was an important thing. Republicans ought to pay attention to this. The Democrats are obviously not going to cede this ground. And the American flag waving still means something to every single one of us. I thought it was really smart to hand them out. Even at the end, they had larger,
the big ones up there.
Yeah, like, they got bigger as the night went on.
That's a powerful image. And look, if we're going to have more patriotism in our politics this fall, I'm for it no matter which party's doing it. So I thought that was a wise choice, and I think it's good because we've seen some disturbing stuff on the streets of America for the last several months, and I'd like to do away with that, and I thought that was a good thing they did.
And that was the Republican on the CNN said talking about that. They are trying to get some American flags up there, and I agree with them. Patriotism would be great. For a while, if you hung up a flag, actually up until a week ago, they would think that, well, you must be a Trump fan instead of an American flag. It would be a trigger if you had a flag. It's nuts. And as I was just saying to myself, just thinking to myself, we're coming up on 250-year anniversary. There's going to be so many things talking about our heritage and our past and patriotism. Now they realize if they want to get the Midwest and South, you can't do it without the American flag. I know. Do they mean it? Are they sincere? We're about to find out. Tim Murtaugh joins us now. A senior advisor who was once an advisor to the Trump campaign is now back. Author of a great book called Swing Hard, In Case You Hit It, My Escape from Addiction and a Shot at Redemption on the Trump campaign. Tim, welcome back. Your thoughts about what that Republican was saying.
Thanks very much for having me back on, Brian. I appreciate it. Yeah, I think Scott Jennings, that was his voice. He does a pretty nice job on CNN. And sure, it was a notable difference. There were American flags at the Democratic National Convention where there had not been flags at DNCs prior to this. And I think it's great. All Americans absolutely should be proud of this country. It's the greatest nation in the history of the world. But I do think it's a little bit odd that everyone is rushing, and I heard all the network announcers as they were doing play-by-play for the convention really talking in hushed and awed tones about the patriotism on display. And I think it's remarkable that they won a cookie or some sort of award or to be patted on the head for being proud of the country for which their candidate is seeking the highest office. I mean, should you not be a patriotic American if you want to be president? I mean, why? I have no idea why it's so notable that a major political party decides to love the country that it's in. I mean, although, you know, to tell you the truth, you can't always count on that because remember, it wasn't very long ago that Michelle Obama said the first time she was ever proud of America was when her husband got elected president. So, you know, I guess it depends on who you talk to and what day it is.
Yeah. So your takeaway from the 4 days?
I think, you know, when I was watching the speech last night, she said something at the end when she was quoting her mother, which made me actually laugh out loud. And I think it actually explains the entirety of the 4 days that we just witnessed. She said that her mother always told her, show them who you are. And the massive, enormous irony in her saying that in the speech, show them who you are. When over the course of these 4 days, the purpose, the very purpose of the DNC has been to do exactly the opposite. They are putting forth a caricature, a person that they just invented. This version of Kamala Harris did not exist 31 days ago. She just simply did not. This is a different person who believes different things than the Kamala Harris of just a month and a day ago. It's really remarkable. The whole thing is the biggest fake, phony, just a festival of lies that I have ever seen.
I want you to hear a little of it. Cut five.
I will be a president who unites us around our highest aspirations, a president who leads and listens, who is realistic, practical, and has common sense, and always fights for the American people. From the courthouse to the White House.
So that's interesting. Always fights for the American people. That and uses common sense. I mean, you guys have been using the term common sense, even Tim, before you joined, because it was just common sense. It's common sense that boys should not be in girls' sports. It's common sense that you secure the border. It's common sense you shouldn't let 99 FBI on the FBI most wanted list into the country. Of course you should back Israel. Of course you don't pay $6 billion to get hostages back. There's just common sense. And now they seem to have realized that was focus group positively and taking it. Tips no longer taxed. Focus group positive, so they decided to take it. How do you guys handle that?
Well, I mean, it's pretty obvious. We have to educate everybody as to who she actually is. They are really doing, and of course they have the assistance of 85% or 90% of the media, which just cheers them on. But everything that she says, Brian, and I mean everything that she says, depends upon her audience not being aware that she is currently the vice president and has been for 3.5 years. If you paid attention to everything that went on and was said in that convention, and you didn't know what was actually happening in the country politically, you would think that that was a convention being run by the party that is actually out of power today.
Yeah.
And they're trying to get back in power, and they're criticizing those who are in power today. No. This is all the same people. It's all the same people. They understand that Americans are in trouble and Americans can't make ends meet and that inflation is still crushing family budgets. They understand all of that. And so they have to run against sort of the doldrums, which is why they're promoting a vibe. They're promoting a mood instead of any actual solutions, because they're the ones who created the problem. And the best thing they can do is try to smile their way through it. And it's just not going to work.
I just want to announce something else. At least 5 Secret Service agents who were on the detail on July 13th when President Trump was almost assassinated have been put on leave as they begin to probe the entire assassination attempt. And yesterday we found out another would-be assassin was in the area. Thankfully, he was stopped. He is a career criminal. It looks like DUI as well as child porn. But he wanted to kill Trump, so he's going to be stopped. We know about the assassin with citizenship in Pakistan and Iran. He was trying to hire somebody to kill Trump. What is that like? How is this different from when you worked for the former president before?
Well, it seems to me that there's a lot more public discussion these days than there had been back then about what the specific threats are and even who they are. I mean, I think there are routinely security threats, I think, to presidents of the United States, no matter who they are. And I don't really recall a time where it was discussed so publicly about this. I think there's now you have the guy, and what a moment that was when he was at the rally in North Carolina, President Trump behind bulletproof glass up there on the stage, and an elderly woman fell ill in the crowd, and he actually left the bulletproof booth and went out into the crowd. I'm sure the Secret Service didn't like that at all, but he went out to check on her. That's something there. I mean, if Kamala Harris had ever done that and gone out into the crowd, the media would still be unconscious from having swooned from excitement and over that. But then you had Nancy Pelosi going on TV during the Democratic National Convention and rolling out her same old hyper supercharged red hot rhetoric about how Trump is everything that is a threat to this country. And it's just like when we had to fight against the British, and it's just like when we had to put down the Confederacy. It's just like that. I mean, she's inviting someone to take another shot at him. It's exactly what happened the first time, and they're doing it again, and the media just sits there and nods along with them, and it creates a very dangerous atmosphere. So that's what's different.
So here's what President Trump said yesterday that was missing right after he called into Brett Baer's show, missing from the event. Cut 16.
There was a lot of complaining. She didn't talk about China. She didn't talk about fracking. She didn't talk about crime. She didn't talk about 70% of our people are living in poverty. She didn't talk about housing, really, the trade deficit. She didn't talk about child trafficking that she's allowed to happen because she was the border czar and she presided over the weakest border in the history of our country.
So that's true. The president was on his game. He opened up with us. He did a press conference, did interviews, met with families, then called into Brett Baer last night, and then called into Gutfeld late at night. So anyone who says that he was not picking up the pace is not watching him last week. So what is this week? People say wait till after Labor Day, but I don't see it. I think you had 74 days left. You can't wait a week. What's the plan, Tim?
Yeah, well, he's going to still be hitting every state that he can possibly hit. On today, he's going to be in two states, as a matter of fact. Kamala Harris is taking the day off. She's really worn out after being celebrated by the national news media. That, you know, it's rough work being the toast of the town. So she's going to take the weekend off, is what I understand. But today, Donald Trump's going to be in both Arizona and Nevada for two events, one in each event, and then continue on. There is no rest for President Trump. Let me tell you, he's going to be working and campaigning and working and campaigning every day. We don't have that many days left. And there's a lot of work to be done to educate people and put some meat on the bones as to exactly who Kamala Harris is. And he's exactly right. There are a million things that she did not talk about because, again, she cannot let on and let anyone figure out that she has been, you know, many days we think maybe she's been effectively acting president because we know that Biden is indisposed much of the time. So she completely and totally owns all of these disasters. You know, in her speech last night, she didn't even say the word inflation. It was not even mentioned. But she mentioned Donald Trump's name 15 times, but couldn't talk about it. She didn't even mention inflation in terms of the effects of it. Forget about just using the word inflation. She didn't even talk about the effect of inflation. She's running away from everything. She's using staff to flip her positions on positions that she's held for decades. She says that she no longer opposes fracking, but we had never heard that from her. We got it from an anonymous staffer who leaked it to somebody and pretended it was a scoop. Let me tell you, when you have a 20-year history of opposing getting natural gas out of the ground, you're going to have a hard time in the state of Pennsylvania.
They're in a pause and no one's talking about that. They're not allowing LNG leases at this moment. They said they have enough, which is nuts. Tim, RFK is supposed to not only drop out but endorse President Trump. What could you tell us?
Well, I'm afraid I can't go beyond what the president has already said, which is that he has known RFK Jr. for a long time. He admires him. He thinks he's a smart man. He would welcome his endorsement. He would embrace his endorsement. I know that RFK has an event later on today, and the president has announced that he himself is going to have a special guest at his event, which is later on. They're both doing RFK and Trump. Both doing events in Arizona today, but I'm not going to break any news here with you, Brian. You're going to have to stay tuned just like everybody else. President Trump will make what announcements he believes are relevant, and I'm sure RFK will make his own decisions.
What do you think it does? If he does endorse and he does go out on the campaign trail, what changes?
If he were, I think it would be a boost to the campaign, no question. I think that if you look at the polling, I think that there's a good case to be made that it would be beneficial. But again, that's the decision that RFK is going to make. The president has already said that he would absolutely embrace it and welcome it. And so we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. I don't have any special insight.
Lastly, it was good news, I guess, for the Trump camp. Governor Brian Kemp says, I'm all in, and Donald Trump says he's a great guy. Have you heard anything about working together?
Oh, sure. And also the governor of Arizona also posted on X today that, you know, we got to get Donald Trump reelected and also endorse Carrie Lake for the U.S. Former governor, I'm sorry, also endorsed Carrie Lake for U.S. Senate. So it's very important. And I think it's very heartening, and it's good for the prospects in November for everybody across the board.
Because it's going to be one
everybody's
or two points.
Be rowing in the same. What's that?
It's going to be one or two points, Tim.
Everybody's going to be rowing in the same direction. This is going to be a close election, and there's going to be three or four states that decide it, and it's going to be tens of thousands of votes out of hundreds of millions cast. So it's going to be a tight one.
All right, pick up Tim's book. He's now a member of the Trump team again, but his book's available, Swing Hard in Case You Hit It, My Escape from Addiction and a Shot of Redemption on the Trump Campaign. Tim, go get him. Congratulations on the job. I look forward to talking to you again.
So great to talk to you as always, Brian. Thank you very much.
You got it. Back with your calls. I see you up there, 1-866-408-7669. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show. More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen is the most recommended memory support brand by pharmacists.
All right. It just reminds me to speak now because it's time to find out if there's more to know. By the way, everyone comes in and asks me, can I take a Prevagen? I go, yeah, you can take one because they gave us some free ones. Everyone's like, I got to find out. Everyone's coming back. They love it.
That's why they're disappearing.
Yeah, they are disappearing. It's in a big brain that's hanging out here. Let's find out if there's more to know. Hey, Taylor Swift says that Vienna Terror Pod filled me with fear and guilt. Taylor spoke out Wednesday, the day after the European leg of her Eras Tour ended, and she said she was devastated the three shows in Vienna were canceled, and the reason for the cancellation filled me with a new sense of fear and tremendous amount of guilt because of so many people had planned on coming to those shows. You remember the plot? The plot was this guy, these are young guys, they were going to plow through the audience, they were going to shoot up the audience, it would have been devastating, and then you realize how open and susceptible you are as a performer, especially when you look at what happened to President Trump, the guy's just speaking. An open field of admirers, all you need is one lunatic. Next, Alex Rodriguez shares a cryptic quote after Jennifer Lopez and Ben Affleck divorced. A-Rod, recently social media activity has many believing it's a subliminal message to his ex, with the former Major League slugger sharing a cryptic quote shortly after she filed for divorce. The message A-Rod on Instagram was posted on Tuesday, around the time TMZ broke the news that Lopez officially called it quits. Quote, you either go one way or the other. You might as well be the one deciding the direction. What do you think that means?
I mean, they're saying they're, given that A-Rod was with J-Lo prior to Affleck, you know, they're just wondering if it was his public response to the news.
It means something. Either you go along with it or you and play it to be her sidecar, the guy that's just around with the performer. But look, she's doing this tour. Nobody was buying tickets. She writes an album. No one bought it. Did a documentary. No one saw it.
So how does that respond to her marriage?
No, she's all depressed, and she puts all the pressure on him, probably. He's like, I don't even want to be famous.
That's why he always looks miserable.
He's miserable.
Except
man.
When he's doing a Dunkin'
Everybody
Donuts commercial.
Everybody knows they're miserable. Eric, you called this out a long time ago, right? You said it would never work.
I was the first.
Next. I still don't know what A-Rod means. I don't even know.
Hulk
Hogan event attendee claims she needed 9 stitches after being hit by a beer can. This according to TMZ again. The WWE legend and some of his cohorts were heaving drinks to patrons in the crowd. Remember he came up with a new beer?
Yeah, the real American beer.
When cops say Emma Holakowitz told them one of the flying cans nailed her 50-year-old mom in the noggin. Noggin is short for face, right?
Or head.
Okay. Law enforcement wrote in the report the elder Holakowitz was seen bleeding. Cops say Emma told them her mother needed 9 stitches. I mean, that's the problem with throwing beer around.
You can't throw beer cans into the audience. I mean, that's why you just get a T-shirt cannon to shoot T-shirts,
which
not
we
beer
have.
Cans.
And I'll be doing it at Peekskill, New York, BrianKilmeade.com.
October 20th.
This is Liberty and Lefts. And didn't you say that's one of the things, Eric, we should never do, throw beer cans at parties? Weren't you the first to say that?
I was the one that warned you against doing that originally.
That's true.
And not to aim the T-shirt cannon at anyone's noggin.
He has so much knowledge. J-Lo wants to change her last name from Affleck back to Lopez. Are you going to stand in their way?
Did she change it to Affleck to begin with? I mean, that was...
Had she done her hotels, her checking account? What do her checks say? Do they say
good
Affleck?
Question.
Does he have to change
she
it?
She must change her checks very often.
She should just be J-Lo. She does not... Like Cher doesn't need
a last name. Cher's probably Cher on
does
her
Does Messi check. Even need a name? Messi is just
well, that is his name.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade Show coming your way. Thanks so much for listening all week long. Final hour of the week, depending on where you are. I don't want to mess you up, but one of our final hours of the week. Big hour. Brian Brandberg's going to be with the Jackie DeAngelis. The Fed chair came out and basically said time to cut rates. The market shot up. I want to know what this means. You know, I'm trying to do the show. At the same time, trying to keep in touch with another big story. And the other big story is 5 Secret Service agents that were present to protect Donald Trump on July 13th in Butler, Pennsylvania, have been put on leave. Now, it's taken a long time. I get it. Let's discuss it. The other thing I'm really worried about, and Michael Waltz didn't make me feel any better, who is this kid? Who is this kid? Why did he have encrypted accounts? Why was he at the shooting range? Why was he walking up and down? How was he able to squeeze 8 shots off? You know, why was he basically stalking the whole thing? What was he up to? What do his parents say? I mean, it's not. I know it can't be a like type of scrutiny with Lee Harvey Oswald, but I think it's a pretty big deal that we find out who the shooter is, don't you? Shannon Bream, author of Fox News Sunday, Fox News chief legal analyst, author of The Love Stories of the Bible Speak. We need her to speak. Shannon's still in Chicago, right, Shannon?
Yes, sir, I am.
Where are you going to host your show, though?
I am getting on a plane this afternoon back to D.C.
Okay. Is your philosophy with your show move on or look back?
Well, here's the thing. We maybe have to do both, because for one of these candidates, we don't know if the look back is still the current policy for the move on, or if there's been an evolution and there's been a change. I don't know. We got to go both directions until we find out.
Well, I'll tell you, before I get your take, let's give everybody an idea. I mean, look, if you do a morning show or you have to be up at 8 o'clock, you weren't watching these speeches. It was just too late. Cut five.
I will be a president who unites us around our highest aspirations, a president who leads and listens, who is realistic, practical, and has common sense, and always fights for the American people.
They seem to take a phrase from Trump every day. The new one is common sense. You know, girl, it's common sense. If you're a boy, you should not be in a girl's locker room competing against a girl. It's common sense. Why would you not secure the border? So many things have common sense. Now they're stealing that, too. Your thought about how it was were you in the building?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Your thoughts. What was it like?
I stay up and watch this stuff so you don't have to.
Well, I did watch the replay on another network.
Well, there you go. Another network.
Yeah, we didn't replay it. We analyze.
You know what? I can teach you how to set your DVR. Do you want me to help you with that?
Well, not in the car. What happens is, do you want to know what I do? I get up at 2:30. I'm out of the house at 2:50. From 2:50, I am watching everything possible, but I'm not. I don't travel with a DVR.
You're not part of a TV.
Yeah, I guess Sling. The Sling.
You know
Sling TV.
Stuff?
I should maybe Sling TV would have got me. But go ahead.
Yes, I did watch. I did think it was very interesting. There were a number of themes that seemed to come from the other side of the aisle, like a lot of talk about tax cuts and all kinds of things that do seem like, you know, the whole freedom thing where, you know, obviously conservatives are going to push back on that and talk about things like, you know, snitch lines on your neighbors during COVID. That doesn't feel like freedom. But listen, everybody knows what polls well, freedom, prosperity, future, positivity. You know, there was a lot of talk about moving past division and all this kind of stuff, but there was also a lot of going after President Trump. I mean, that's just what you do in campaigns. So, you know, there was a lot of stuff that you heard at the DNC, which you could have also heard at the RNC.
Free criminals from the burden of bail or punishment, free to let criminals not serve prison time, free to have to get a vax or be ridiculed, free to stay out of school for months unnecessarily. Free to not buy the stove you want or the refrigerator you need. I don't know if that's just a New York thing. Free not to tell your parents you want to switch genders. This is a lot of freedom. Free to bring thousands of illegals here and use your taxpayer money to pay for them. I feel free. Free to rotate your pronouns. This is freedom. I love that party.
Well, listen, I mean, it was all about that, just sort of whatever lane or life that you choose, that is, you know, the government's not going to get in your way. Well, okay, conservatives like that, too. They like the government not getting in their way. They like, so this is going to be about smaller government, like the government getting out of the way of your choices. It seems like there are very specific choices that the Democrats don't want the government involved with, but not everything. So,
Shannon,
you know,
I want to get
freedom is another person's, you know, restriction.
Well, I think freedom used to be easy to define. And now we're finding it's very murky. This is going to be a quiz. Tell me what's missing from this speech on our military. Cut 10.
Okay.
10.
I have confronted threats to our security, negotiated with foreign leaders, strengthened our alliances, and engaged with our brave troops overseas. As Commander-in-Chief, I will ensure America always has the strongest, most lethal fighting force in the world, and I will fulfill our sacred obligation to care for our troops and their families, and I will always honor and never disparage their service and their sacrifice.
Anything missing?
You tell me.
Afghanistan, where she was the last person in the room. There were 13 bodies that came back and men who are brutally wounded. maybe she could talk about that. Maybe she could talk about why she wasn't at Dover, or why when President Biden was taking the hailstorm for his horrible decision, did she go to California and not be seen at all with him? I mean, there's been major death there hasn't been a lot of major death, thankfully, during her time of American troops, but that was the biggest. And his numbers never went over 50% after that. Mm-hmm. The decision not to bring it up.
And she has, post that horrific decision in Afghanistan, said that she stands by it. And that's knowing everything that we know now. So if you have questions about foreign policy and what a Commander-in-Chief Harris would do, I think those are legit questions, because when she was pressed on it, she said, yes, she supported his decisions and she stands by how that played out. So that is a deal breaker for a lot of Americans. And like you said, that was kind of the beginning of the end on the Biden approval ratings, and it never recovered.
And it shouldn't. And I still think about it all the time. And I think about the fact that Joe Biden, you might not know this, but I know somebody that helped put that report together, the after action report, was hired to mm-hmm. do it, was also in, I think it was Qatar or the UAE, where they got everybody out and then had to screen them. So he put it together. They could not get the president first to read the speech. Then he said, well, deliver it to him. And they said, okay, it'll take a half hour. And they go, yeah. He said, no, you got to make it shorter. He said, well, I could do it in 10 minutes. And then the president said, no, he doesn't need it. Just leave it. So he never even would not even get briefed about what mm-hmm. went wrong by the people that did the after action report, which makes me throw up in my mouth. Lastly.
Yeah, and it should every American.
I mean, people have fallen off planes. We don't know who's they ended up on our military bases. So, and the people mm-hmm. left behind, that the people you and I know that had to sacrifice their 401ks yep. to get them out. And we still have mm-hmm. thousands behind enemy lines. But we do have news that I don't think is getting enough attention, because there's so much other stuff going on. But this I thought was huge. Cut 26.
We got to win. You know, we got to win from the top of the ticket on down. I've been saying consistently for a long time, we cannot afford another 4 years of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And I think, you know, Kamala Harris and Tim Walz would be even worse. So we need to send Donald Trump back to the White House. We need to retake the Senate. We need to hold the House. We need to hold our legislative majorities that we have in the great state of Georgia. And it takes hard work. That's what we've been doing.
And then Trump hears this 1 hour later, comes on with you guys. Cut 27.
Well, I just saw Brian on A Very Good Man. Did you ever hear of a man named Sean Hannity? And he was interviewed by Sean Hannity, and he was very nice. And he said he wants Trump to win, and he's going to work with me 100%. And I think we're going to have a very good relationship with Brian Kemp.
This is no small thing. I mean, it's going to be a few thousand votes in Georgia. You need the popular governor. Mm-hmm. They're going at each other's throats for 2 years. It's over.
Yeah, I mean, listen, there was no need for that. We all know what happened with those Senate seats down there. There's been a lot of self-inflicted damage for the GOP, for President Trump, down in Georgia. And now Democrats feel like that state is in play for them. He needed to make nice with Governor Kemp, who, listen, was always going to support President Trump over Vice President Harris. But for them to publicly do this thing, I think it's very helpful for both of them, where the GOP is concerned.
But I think it's huge news, because if Kemp could say, I'll vote for you, but he's got a machine in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
You know this. Mm-hmm. And if he gets that machine, I mean, they beat the star. Stacey Abrams wasn't even there. She was supposed to be the next generation. And he took her out just on pure merit and organization. You cannot afford to be enemies with that governor. That and RFK Jr. Mm-hmm. today. This is the first two things that's happened over the last 3 weeks that brings momentum a little bit to Trump's camp. And when that happens, conventional wisdom says he gets a couple of points out of it, and he gets somebody that was sucking some voters from him, especially if he's active in campaigning for Trump, don't you think?
Yeah, and that'll be the question, too. I mean, how active is he going to be? Of course, not a guarantee that all 100% of his people go over to Trump, but RFK Jr. has been sort of receding a little bit in the polling now that Biden's off the ticket. People feel like they have another option, potentially with Harris. But most of the polling shows that he has pulled more away from the Trump camp than he has from the Biden or Harris camp. So, you know, the Trump team is excited. They're welcoming this. If it happens this afternoon, I think it's going to be very good for them. It's certainly a net plus, not minus.
So who are you going to have on this weekend?
I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you.
I'd rather, not
die. We actually do have a couple of really good guests that I can't announce until this afternoon on social. but you're definitely going to want to tune in. A couple people in the middle of everything that's happening. I think it's going to be a very interesting conversation.
Well, what do you think? Do you think that we had some breakthroughs with Democrats over there in Chicago?
In what way?
We have more Democrats on our air last week, this week.
Yes, I always think that's good. And listen, the people who come on with us, I think, always leave feeling they've been treated fairly. I really do. I mean, we repeat customers is not our problem. It's first timers, I think, sometimes. And then once people come, they have a good experience, realize that they're going to get a chance to, you know, debate their ideas. I mean, to me, an interesting, informative show is one that has all different viewpoints. And so we love having folks. The door's open.
Right. Should we disagree more? Would that help my show?
I don't know, but who have you got Saturday night?
Oh, thanks you for asking. Anthony Robbins did this, executive produced this, this great movie on child trafficking and what's going on here. And knowing that they announced this week that we've lost track of 80,000 kids here.
At least.
Maybe more. Mm-hmm. So I just thought it was very apropos, plus he's inspirational. I also have a surprise with him. Number two, we have Hugh Hewitt, who I like to have people on smarter than me like you. He's one of them. Mm-hmm. And then Douglas Murray.
So Douglas Murray. He's always got something interesting going on, too. I just want to know, are you and Anthony Robbins, they're going to be like a push-up contest or something?
Anthony Robbins?
Yeah.
He can't keep up with me. And you want me to embarrass
That's
him?
That's what I thought. Right. Yeah. He doesn't want a piece of that, right?
Right. Most inspirational guy you'll ever be around. But he made a science of improving people's lives. He doesn't say, hey, look me in the eye. I'm going to give you a pep talk. You know, he tells you how to do it.
Could you get him to make me a video to help me, like, in the mornings I don't want to get up and go to the gym? Maybe a cameo.
That's what you
Maybe
have a husband like for. That. Cameo? You have to pay for it. I'm not having him do it. Do you really think Anthony Robbins on Cameo with George Santos?
I need a personalized message, not from George Santos. I don't find that motivating. But maybe Anthony Robbins, like, Bream, get up now. Your life is going to be so much better when you get to the gym.
I think he's actually, you know what I found out? So I sat down with Katie. I don't know if I told you this. So I go, Katie was at that time in 10th grade. I said, you want to hear the most inspirational guy you're ever going to hear? She's like, no, I don't. I go, you know, you have to. And then finally, I just go, you have to sit down. I had to turn it off. You know why?
Why?
He does curse a lot. And I'm saying to myself, after a while, she goes, really, Dad? You really think I should be listening to this? I go, you can go now.
For kids, but listen, the best drill sergeants, they've got some saucy language too.
Right. Absolutely.
It's motivating.
Like, yeah, I know with Gomer Pyle when he was in the Marines, there was a lot that was going on there. I think I should have hung up with you a few minutes ago. I feel bad.
Okay, goodbye.
Shannon, thanks
Saturday.
So much.
You come see me Sunday.
And don't forget, Fox News Sunday, Shannon Bream, starring Shannon Bream as Shannon Bream. Back in a moment.
Okay, bye.
Hear the ins and outs of the 2024 election right here. The Brian Kilmeade Show. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Well, you're right about the force with which it was delivered. It was a forceful speech. Delivered very crisply, very professionally, with emphasis. There was no stumbling, fumbling, or any of that. It is, however, I think, on paper at least, a speech that Joe Biden could have given. What Joe Biden could not have done at any point, in my view, in his presidency was to deliver the speech with the force and effect that she delivered this speech tonight. It was very strong.
Delivery was better. And the one thing that Trump came up with and just said, and called into Brett Baer last night and said after, you know, all this stuff that she said she's going to do and she wants to do, she could be doing. She could be making it clear. And by the way, Joe Biden is not doing anything. Nothing's on his schedule out in California. She could almost assume the presidency and let him do whatever he does. They say when you're a lame duck president, your body, your workload goes down. My feeling is, are you kidding? There's so much to do. Now you have the Fed cutting rates. You have the suspension of five Secret Service agents. You had the would-be assassination, the assassin en route to try to shoot at Trump yesterday at the border. You know, there's a lot to do, but evidently not for Joe Biden, who's ticked off. Don't let anybody tell you there isn't a minor civil war going on the Democratic side. They kicked him to the curb, didn't admit it. They didn't admit he was failing when he was failing. Then they didn't admit that he was susceptible when he was susceptible. Then he said he wasn't going anywhere, but behind the scenes they made sure he could go nowhere. And then Kamala Harris emerges without a Josh Shapiro or Governor Beshear even have an opportunity, or Governor Newsom even put their hat in the ring. What also does it say that Gavin Newsom had no speaking spot? Man, somebody in charge does not like him or feels threatened by him. That's for them to work out. I am not sure. He did a bunch of interviews. He did a couple on Fox, but they don't want no part of him. Judy, listening to KFTK in St. Louis. Hey, Judy.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
No problem. What's on your mind today?
Well, first, I want to say thank you very much for having a radio show where I feel like I can trust the information that you and your team put together, that it's not going to be biased or false.
That's one of the nicest things you could say. Now, what do you think about those 4 days we just witnessed?
I did not enjoy them. that really wasn't the reason that I called, but I just did not enjoy them. I hate to say this, but someone just walked in my office and I do have to run. So thank you very much. And I definitely appreciate your honesty and your reporting skills.
Wow. So that's fascinating. That is never, I've heard, you know, people get disconnected before. I never heard someone walk to my office. Well, you could get in trouble. It makes sense. You know, calling from home, you know, calling at work.
And she was on hold for quite a long time.
She waited 45 minutes.
Murphy's Law. Always happens.
All right. So when we come back, Brian Brandberg is going to be with us. Jackie DeAngelis is going to be here, co-host of The Big Money Show. This is one of those days you're going to remember because, number one, DNC's done. 74 days until we, 74 days till we get a new president or somebody's going to win the election roughly in that period. And it's either side's to win. But also it's going to be circumstances, some of which you can't control. Because unemployment's gone up and inflation hasn't gone up at the same rate, they now feel at the Fed they can cut rates. What does it mean? Well, now the market's up 461 points. They're at 41,000. 2 weeks ago, it lost about 1,000 points. Also today, RFK is going to be speaking in Arizona. President Trump speaking in Arizona. Will they meet and announce a big endorsement? That can open every battleground state.
Fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
The time has come for policy to adjust. The direction of travel is clear, and the timing and pace of rate cuts will depend on incoming data, the evolving outlook, and the balance of risks. We will do everything we can to support a strong labor market as we make further progress toward price stability. With an appropriate dialing back of policy restraint, there is good reason to think that the economy will get back to 2% inflation while maintaining a strong labor market.
All right, so what does that mean and what kind of rate cut are we looking at and how has the market responded? I could tell you, but the experts are here to make sense of it all. Brian Brandberg is here and Jackie DeAngelis. They all are part of the three-headed co-hosts of the Big Money Show that starts shortly, 1 o'clock.
We're missing our other head.
Three-headed.
Right. All right, so Jackie, if you would move a little closer to the microphone. Yes. I mean, we have good technology. It's not okay. Great. I mean, so first off, what kind of cut are we getting and what significance of what Jay Powell said over in Jackson Hole?
Hard to say what kind of cut we're getting, whether it'll be 25 basis points or 50 basis points. I don't think he could do much more than that, but he is broadcasting to the market that they're going to get the cut that they wanted. Why is he broadcasting that? Because we got this data. The last jobs report was weak. Then we got the revisions, which indicated that the labor market is even weaker. What Jerome Powell's trying to do and what I think is dangerous here is he's trying to walk a tightrope. In that soundbite, he mentioned a strong labor market. He doesn't want too many people to lose their jobs because that would be bad, you know, for the overall economy and for America at large. What he's trying to do is cut rates to stimulate just a little bit to keep corporations not laying people off. And, you know, it's like Simone Biles trying to stick a gymnast landing. Like sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't.
It does always for her, though, I think.
For her.
Right.
But he's not as good as Simone Biles, trust me.
Just collectively, I'm willing to lose the analogy to move on with the...
Please.
Okay. So Brian, but why is the market responding like this? They're just pleased.
Because
right?
What you played a very boring... very boring clip right at the top. It was Fed speak, and he was saying blah, 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 blah. What he said was, hey, everybody, rates are coming down. we think we won. And the market said, oh, that's what we want to hear. We want to see interest rates come down, because if we're tech investors, if we're growth investors, rates coming down means these stocks can go up. And the market is responding to that. He just gave a big victory signal. And it's a big deal for him to say what he said. That it was a very aggressive speech when it comes to how the Fed speaks.
But if he's wrong, and he's been wrong before when he said inflation was transitory and he waited
She's
so long.
She's talking about
Jay Powell, so right. long to raise rates. If he's wrong here and he cuts too soon and the market, or pardon me, not really the stock market, because they always want to cut, but the economy isn't ready to absorb that, he risks sending inflation higher.
Okay. But don't you think the amount of a rate cut is key? Like, we don't know.
Yeah.
So,
right.
So, and how are the...
I think he's going to do 25 basis points at this next meeting.
So how does that affect if Mr. and Mrs. Johnson want to take out a loan or want to go get a mortgage?
That first cut's not going to make a big deal. I mean, it's 25 basis points. If you're paying 6.5, 6.75 on your mortgage...
Is that what we're paying now?
About 6.5%. But what it starts getting people thinking about is, well, if he's going to do that in September, he's going to do it again before the end of the year, maybe twice. And he's going to do it probably 4 or 5 times next year, which means, oh, maybe my mortgage can get down to 5% range by the time I get to the end of 2025. That starts to get interesting, because you've got people piled up who wanted to buy homes
right.
for a couple years and there's nothing on the market. So this could break that logjam, except you've got a presidential candidate talking about giving $25,000 to new home buyers, which, if you did that,
right.
would send prices way back up.
So you're going to tell me the market would respond and not just keep the house at the same amount?
Yeah,
believe it or not, prices will
Brian.
Respond for yeah. sure. And actually, to Brian's point, if you get a Kamala presidency and this $25,000 credit for first-time home buyers goes through, that will change the whole dynamic of how Jerome Powell operates and where rates should be. And so ultimately, that's also why I think it's risky with respect to what he's doing, because we don't know who's going to be the president. We don't know what kind of policy
right.
will be in place.
So let's say what we hear we know, because we don't hear it from the vice president. We hear it from people who will not give their names to
right.
reputable organizations. So it looks like she wants to raise the core. If she wins, she'll raise the corporate rate from 21 mm-hmm. to 28. So people look at that and say, so what? These corporations can afford it. But that's really not what the corporate rate is it?
No, if you say corporations can afford it, you haven't spent a lot of time thinking about how corporations make decisions. If their tax rate goes up from 21 to 28, they say, okay, where do we cut back? Just like anybody has to. And that's probably going to be in investing in their business, which grows it, or it's going to be who they hire, okay?
Yeah, or lay off.
Or wages. So look, corporations pass all of that tax down. Just like a business, a grocery store, when they get hit with inflation, they pass it on to consumers. It ends up in your pocket or getting taken out of your pocket.
And I hate to be the grim reaper, but I can't help it. Ultimately, what will happen if you raise the rate to 28%, people will lose their jobs. And that recession that Jerome Powell's been desperately trying to avoid, if we're not in a soft recession right now, it will come as a result of that. The whole point of how Trump tries to do it mm-hmm. with tax cuts, it's not to enrich corporations the way the left likes to spin it. It is to foster growth, because growth is the engine that fuels our economy. Everybody benefits when corporations are growing.
Right. They just see a CEO and they think how rich Jamie Dimon is.
Right.
But they don't understand. There's secretary, there's interns.
They
employ the vice presidents. There's custodians. They clean the building. There's realtors. There's commercial realtors that are going to get commissioned by selling another building.
That's right.
Leases that got to be signed. But I just think that if someone like me can figure that out with no discernible business background, that we know of, I'm still searching, why can't politicians figure that out?
Well, they know the truth. So last night, what really troubled me about what Kamala was saying, she went through a whole list of, we're not going to cut this, we're not going to cut that, we're going to keep spending. Where are you going to get the money? Are you trying to get it from corporations? Will be one way, but ultimately everybody's yeah. taxes are going to go up if you want to keep spending like that. And that was the biggest problem with the Biden-Harris administration. Spending is what triggered this crazy inflation.
How about this? She's debating a wealth tax.
Yeah.
What would that be? I mean, do you have any idea? Have people played game planned this out to you?
I mean, it means somebody would come over to your house and say, all right, what do you got going on over here? You got a house. You got some. You got a yard. I don't know if you have art. Maybe you're an art guy. I don't know if you're an art guy. You got some cars, maybe.
Something of worth.
You've got some financial assets. And they're going to say, wow, we think those are worth more today than they were at the beginning of last year. And so we're going to tax you on the difference. You don't have any cash in your pocket, but you'll have to give us cash for how much those increase. And by the way, every country that's tried that has dropped it because it is such a disaster.
Right.
Wealth flees.
I also think we're talking about two different things. So what Brian's talking about is the tax on unrealized capital gains, which also will impact your stock investments, whether it's in your 401k, pension, personal account, whatever it is. So that's number one. You're talking about a wealth tax, which I think is ultimately going to end up, could manifest itself in, you're in this net worth, you're in the top of the 1%, you've got X amount of dollars as a minimum threshold. We want X percent of that just because.
Just because. So here we go. If you are a billionaire, you're only paying 8%. We keep hearing Joe Biden say that. So it's a much more complex thing than just say on average you pay 8%. So they just say you can afford to pay 16%.
Right.
Is it more complicated than that?
It's way more complicated than that. The guys who are telling you they want to fix that are the ones who wrote the tax code to give you the opportunity, if you have a loss, to deduct that from your taxes.
Yeah.
Or if you have a gain, you got to pay taxes on it. They wrote the code. These guys have to pay taxes just like everybody else, but there's a complicated tax code, and that makes their rate actually fairly complicated when you look at income taxes.
Well, that's on the income side. And then the other side of the high net worth individuals in this country, they use vehicles like trusts, and they take advantage of estate laws and all different kinds of things to transfer wealth down through the generations without having to pay tax on it. Now, the reason I suspect they don't go to modify that is because ultimately, yes, you have rich Republicans, but you've got rich Democrats, too, that are funding the Democrat machine, and they don't want to go after those people in their party. So ultimately, what they want to try to do is just say, we'll raise taxes on everybody, the billionaires and millionaires, sure, but then those people who are earning over $400,000. If you live in certain cities in this country, you know that once you pay your taxes, there's not much left after $400,000 to live in San Francisco or New York City, especially if you're supporting a family.
So they came out last night and she says, I'm from the middle class, did the vice president. So I know what it's like. I'm going to give a middle class tax cut. And what Donald Trump will do is continue to give his billionaires tax cuts. So he's going to raise from 37 to 39, the top threshold. And then she's going to give him middle class tax cuts. Tax reform did I understand that tax reform benefited the middle class more than any other class.
The Trump tax cuts. She's allowing to expire, by the way. So we don't know what her tax policy is going to look like specifically because she won't tell us. But she wants to help the middle class, and she's letting those tax cuts expire. It doesn't make sense.
Because she believes that she can successfully label Trump a billionaire who doesn't care about little people, and tax reform was for the billionaires who are financing his campaign.
Right. Yeah. And to me, I think she's lying. I think she lied about a lot of things last night, and she's lying because if she really wanted to help the middle class, she'd leave those tax cuts in place and then do reform around that. But she's lying to you to say, no, we're going to get rid of that, and then we're going to do something else later, but she's not telling us what it is. That is what troubles me.
Yeah, there's a lot that troubles me that has to be worked out. What I also think is, too, is there are people behind the scenes that know exactly what she's going to do. The fact that people don't want to tell you what she's going to do, they should be proud to tell you that their vision for growing the economy, but they're not. Is it that big of a deal going from 37.1 to 39 on the upper tax rate? Because that's all Trump did is take it down one. She wants to bring it up too.
Yeah, every tax change matters. Every tax change affects behavior. The problem with saying you want to raise the upper rate from 37 to 39 is it's not the only thing that you want to do. It's not the only thing she wants to do. They want to scrap all of the Trump tax cuts. They label the Trump tax cuts as a billionaire tax cut. It's not a billionaire tax cut. It's a tax cut for everybody. So I don't think anybody should play the game of, well, all they want to do is take the top rate up. Ask for the whole plan and ask for the fine print it's much more than that.
By the way, Brian, it's still not going to be enough money to pay for all the things that she wants to do. And we've talked about this before, that the top 1% pays almost half or 42, 43% of the federal taxes as it is right now. You don't want to squeeze those people. They invest money back into the economy. They also are the innovators. They're sort of part of this capitalist engine. If you go after them in that way, you start to chip away at the system, which is ultimately what they want to do.
So if they do the average, let's just take Joe Biden at his word. And he says, I did the average. I look at the billionaires and they're only paying on average 8%. What you guys will tell me is there's a reason. So not your goal is just exactly what Trump said in 2016, to pay as little tax as possible legally.
Yeah.
So what you do is you got to say, I'm going to invest. If I take a loss, I could use a loss against my taxes.
Right.
But when you go and take a loss and did a business, you hire people, you lease a building, you have car, people got to drive there. That's going to bring in help to municipalities. So then people have an opportunity to grow. So, you know, I need a loss. I always had this idea about spinning off this way. I'm going to give that a shot.
Yeah.
Disney wants to expand. This might be a good time for Disney to get that park bigger.
Yeah.
People have to, you have to Imagineers and everything else. So that's what you want. You want people using their imagination in order to pay as little tax as possible at the same time growing the economy.
To take risks.
Yes.
Capitalism works on risk, and a risk sometimes
pays off. And if you're a public
off,
company, you want to tell those shareholders why you're doing it.
And you want to encourage that kind of risk taking. That's how we got to where we are. But these guys want to penalize the dynamism of capitalism. They want it to be planned from the top.
Because you cheated. You're successful. You cheated.
That's right.
Generational wealth is because you cheat.
Always ignoring the failures, always ignoring the risk, always ignoring what didn't work out, assuming that you got your wealth by birthright, when in fact most billionaires and millionaires earned the dang money by working hard in uncertain environments.
Jackie, you think what I'm thinking?
What?
That I easily could, if someone was to turn an ankle, I could fill in on your show.
Oh.
Are you thinking, is that what you were thinking?
No, I wasn't thinking that. I was actually thinking about Michelle Obama talking about how she grew up and that her parents didn't take more than they needed. I don't have a problem with her saying that, but you're standing on the stage and you are taking more than you need.
$100 million.
And I don't even have a problem with that, but you can't talk out of both sides of your mouth.
I didn't think so.
Right.
But it's okay. She's a genius. We all know that. We're going to watch you guys at 1 o'clock. I hope you didn't leave the game here. That's my word.
Oh, no. It's just warming up, man. That was just like 55-yard warm-up pass.
You didn't pull anything, did you?
No, Brian? No. We're feeling good.
Brian Brenberg, Jackie DeAngelis, all part of the Big Money Show on FBN in an hour and 10 minutes.
That's right.
1 o'clock Eastern. See you there.
That's one way to say it.
Learning something new every day on the Brian Kilmeade Show. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
She's lived a life like ours. She knows us. Donald Trump doesn't know you at all. You think he understands that when your car breaks down, you can't get to work? No. His first word was probably chauffeur.
All right, good luck with that. So you really think you're going to define Donald Trump? That's what you're going to use your time for? She's kind of odd because here she was. She was talking about, well, she should be the running mate for Joe Biden. Remember, Joe Biden really liked her. And she said, no, thanks. Okay. And then during this whole scramble to be the running mate, she has no interest in being Kamala's running mate either.
You mean Gretchen Whitmer?
Gretchen Whitmer.
Yes.
Isn't it kind of weird? You know she's ambitious. She's just not ambitious now.
But, I mean, also, how would the country feel about two women on the ticket? Like, does she know, or do the Dems over to the polling know? It wouldn't have even been an option.
Right. But why does she care about that? Why not just use it to raise your profile? Do a bunch of interviews. She's got a book out.
Or you'd rather sit back and then wait 4 years to then really have a better opportunity.
Well, this is the second time now. I mean, she could have been part of 2020. And then.
Well, in 2020, she couldn't have because she's not a black woman.
But that was officially. He called her up and said, I want you to be one of the finalists. I want you to keep your name. He goes, no, I don't think so. You know, you should just hire a minority. But Biden asked her to be a finalist, and she said no.
Well, then she's also towing the line, being like, he needed to pick the black woman, right?
Right. I guess she didn't want to be looked at someone in between. Here's what Gavin Newsom said on why he had no prominent role. He's just sitting in the audience. He was on with Brett. Cut 29.
Is there any little part of you that wants to be on that stage tonight accepting this nomination?
No, there's
just a little bit.
No.
Just a little bit.
No, I don't need the stress in my life. I like my kids. I like spending time with them. I was able to bring them to school, first day of school on Monday. That's the joy that I'm experiencing, not just the joy that's expressed in the convention. I'll be in the front row. You'll see me applauding a friend of almost 30 years. We knew each other before we were both in politics.
By the way, it can't be a good relationship. There's no way. If she's your friend, you give him a prominent role, a common introduction, anything. By the way, her montage was not great. I watched it back. The other thing, One Nation, Saturday night, 9 o'clock. We have Douglas Murray, Smart As It Gets, You, it's fantastic. Anthony Robbins, he's in a child trafficking movie that you're going to absolutely see is so important, and it's just so important to what's out there. It's really compelling. He also is going to talk about inspiring this country at this point. We also have another great guest, Glenn Greenwald, is going to be great. And Emily Wilson's going to be with us, and Tom Shalhoub. It's going to be a big show, Saturday, 9 o'clock Eastern time. And don't forget, Peekskill, New York, History, Liberty, and Laughs, on stage, having a great time. Get the VIP. This way I can talk to you before the show. I bring history to life like you've never seen before. BrianKilney.com.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.